So we're continuing our study of Perek Aleph. Kind of pushed all the subjects off 1 week because we took one subject and split it over two. I hope that doesn't happen too often. And our goal is to discuss a little bit of the story of Ruth and her, quote unquote, her conversion, right? It is famously known as the conversion of Ruth. We are continuing our study on Perek Aleph. So after Naomi decides to return, we were left off at Pasuk Vav. Vatakomi vachaloteha vatashov misde Moav. Ki shama'a bisde Moav ki fakad Hashem etamo latet lahem lachem. So Naomi and her daughters-in-law, at this point, both of them, picked themselves up and began to return from Moav to Beit Lechem, because they heard that God had remembered his people and gave them bread, which, again, euphemistically, we connected to the end of the war with Moab and post-Yiftach world and in Beit Lechem. Vatetze min ha-makom asher hayta shama u'shtei chaloteha imah. Naomi is the catalyst. She's the one returning, and she brings her two daughters-in-law with her, or they go with her. Vatelachna baderech lashuv el eretz Yehuda, begin the journey back to the land of Judah. It's quite a journey. I just wanted to make the observation, and I'll show you this on a map. This is Eretz Moav, and this is Ammon, and this is Shevet Reuven. Here's Beit Lechem. So I just wanted to make the observation that to go from Beit Lechem to Eretz Moav, you really have to go the distance, right? You either have to cut across all of the tribe of Reuben and Gad and then go south, or go south initially and then cross over the Arden here. But it's not just like a neighboring town, right? You really have to cross over the area of the Dead Sea, and that's quite a journey. Nonetheless, that's what Elimelech was going, and now Naomi begins her journey home. Vatoma Naomi l'shtei chalotah. She turns to her two daughters-in-law, and she says to them, Lech na shovna isha levet ima. My daughters-in-law, go home each to your mother's house. Yas Hashem imachem chesed ka'asher asitem im hamitim v'imadi. May God pay you kindness the way you have shown kindness to me and with the deceased. And we're going to talk about what that means in a moment. Yiten Hashem lachem umitzena menucha isha beit isha. May God grant you that you find rest in her husband's house. Meaning, go find yourselves husbands. Go find yourselves homes. Go build yourselves a life. Because with me, you'll have none of that. Vatishaklan, she kissed them, vatisena kolan, vativkena, they raised up their voices in tears and in crying. Vatamarnala, they said, no, kitachna shuvlamech, we want to go back with you, we want to go to your people. And she says to them, no, vatomenomi, shov navnotai, return my daughters, lamatelach naimi, what are you going to come with me for? Do I have more sons in my womb that can be husbands to you? Shovna v'natai, lechna. Go home. Izakanti miot le'ish. I'm too old to have a husband and more children. Ki amarti yesh li tikva ki iti alayla le'ish. Kam iladati v'gam iladati banim. Alehen tisaberna ad ashe yigdalu. Alehen tiagena levetiyot le'ish. Even if I were to have a husband and get pregnant tonight and have children, are you going to wait for them to grow up so that you can marry them? Al v'natai. No, my daughters. Ki marli ma'od mikem. Very bitter for me because for on your behalf. Ki yatzabi ad Hashem, God's hand has been against me. Vatisena kolan vativkena od, again cried. Vatishak orpa lachamota verut davkaba. Orpa kissed her mother-in-law, Verut, on the other hand, clung to her. Vatome, so she said to Ruth, hine shava yivimtech elamav el eloel. Your sister-in-law has returned to her people and to her God. Go follow your sister-in-law's example. Don't press me to leave you. Where you go, I will go. Where you sleep, I will sleep. Where your people are my people, your God is my God. Where you die, I die, and there I will be buried. So, which is an expression of an oath, is right, God shall do to me and more as well, is a kind of a is an idiomatic expression for an oath, even if death separate us, or only death shall separate us. Ki amavet yafid ben yubenech. So she saw that she was determined. So Naomi let her be and stopped pushing. And the two of them came to Beit Lechem. That's all we're going to deal with today. All right, so let's come back to the question of the chesed that she refers to here. Chesed is a major theme in Megillat Rut. We're going to address that in some other context a little bit later in the book. But Chazal make the observation that the entire book of Rut was written just for the characteristic trait of kindness of chesed. And in the text itself, there's a chesed attributed to Ruth, there's a chesed attributed to God, there's a chesed attributed to Boaz. Boaz refers to Ruth as somebody who does chesed. There's a constant theme of chesed in the story. But in this context, Naomi starts the journey back, because, again, ostensibly the war is over. And she turns to her daughters-in-law who have come with her on this journey, and she says to them, essentially, God should repay you your kindness. You've done your kindness. Yes, Hashem imachem chesed, ka'asher asitem imameitim bi'imadi. May God pay you back the kindness that you have shown to the deceased and with me. What is the kindness that they have shown to the deceased? That phrase, chesed im hametim, right, the kindness to her, they're her daughters-in-law, they came with her. But the kindness to her, to the deceased husbands, that's really a phrase that needs to be understood or unpacked in the context of the Megillah. What is she referring to? Because she makes reference to it, Boaz will make reference to it. What exactly is this kindness that Naomi is referring to? So the answer here, I think, is it's a window into a very big topic, but a very important one for us. She makes reference several times to Naomi, to Orpah in relation to Ruth. She calls her Yivimtech, her Yivama. Yivama is a sister-in-law. And of course, it makes reference to a mitzvah in the Torah that sounds very similar, the mitzvah of Yibum. And so I really want to talk about the mitzvah of Yibum and what it means and how it fits into the story of, into our story. But for whatever the context, the daughters-in-law, both Naomi and Ruth, seem to be accompanying Naomi as an act of chesed, both to Naomi and to the deceased. And in a certain sense, Naomi releases them of that obligation and says to them, go home to your mother's house, go home to your husband's house, go find husbands. Right? In a sense, she releases them of that obligation. So what obligation or what chesed with the deceased is she referring to? So just a quick reminder, is a story in the mitzvah in the Torah, which is going to become a major theme for us in the Megillah. Mitzvah in the Torah of Yibum, and I want to just take a quick glance at the psukim themselves that define the mitzvah of Yibum. So this is in Devarim Parakhov Hey, chapter 25. Ki yeshu achim yachdav umet achad mehem uven en lo. Two brothers dwell in, right, meaning they have two brothers, they're both alive. One dies without children. Lo tiye eshet hamet hachutza li'ish zah. The wife of the deceased may not go outside and marry another meaning the widow, cannot go and marry just another, a stranger outside of the family, is referred to as a tsar, but rather, yivama yavo aleha. The brother-in-law, the husband's brother, must go to on her, meaning must take her, ulekachalo leisha veyibma, and take her as a wife, and fulfill the obligation of the brother-in-law, veyibma. The firstborn of the child from this union of the widow with the brother-in-law will be established, shall establish the name of the deceased husband, so that his name not to be blotted out of Israel. Very interesting, Machloket Rashi and Ramban, whether that's a figurative expression, meaning that by the act of Yibum, the mitzvah continues the lineage of the family through the brother, or whether or not it's a literal expression, the first child born has to be called by the name of the deceased brother. Rashi makes that second argument. It's hard to sustain in terms of the pshat of the mitzvah of Yibum and the examples of Yibum that we have in the Torah, but nonetheless, that is the concept. V'im, and if he refuses, now the husband can refuse the brother. The brother doesn't want to take the wife of the widow, then the widow, the wife of the deceased brother, shall go up to the Sha'ar, the gate of the city where the Sanhedrin sits, El Azkenim, and she shall say to the Zkenim, the Amra, Me'ein yibami la'akim achiv shem b'Yisrael, lo'avaya b'mi. My brother-in-law is refusing to fulfill his duty to establish a name for the deceased, and refuses to perform the duty of the brother-in-law. So she makes this claim to the Zkenim, the Karulo Zikneiro, so then the elders will call him, summon him to the Beit Din, the Dibruela, they'll speak to him, V'amad, V'amar, L'chafatz L'kachta, and he'll make this public declaration, I don't want to take her. V'nigsha Yivimto, then the brother's wife shall come to him in his presence, is the famous act of chalitza. She'll take the shoe off from his foot, and she'll spit in his face, but meaning at the floor in front of him. And she'll publicly humiliate him in such a way that it shall be proclaimed that so shall be done to the man who does not build his brother's house. Instead of establishing the name of the deceased brother, right, the whole point was to continue the seed, to continue the line of the deceased brother as an obligate, as a moral obligation. Now he refused, so instead his the name of his household shall be called Bet Chalutzanal, which is a way of saying he'd be shamed and shunned in the community of Israel for having refused to fulfill the moral obligation of Yibum. That's the mitzvah of Yibum as it appears in the Torah. Couple of interesting observations about the mitzvah. We don't do this anymore for obvious reasons, because you can only fulfill the obligation of the mitzvah of Yibam in a society in which polygamy was allowed, because it could very well be that the brother, the surviving brother, is already married, right? So there's a second wife. So therefore, in the context of today's world, we don't do the mitzvah of Yibam at all. However, in the context of Tanakh and the biblical arena, Yibam was a very foundational mitzvah. And it was considered a moral requirement, obligation of the surviving brother to fulfill that obligation. It's the wife, the widow of the deceased husband, who demands the mitzvah of Yibum be fulfilled. That she's the one who comes to the Zkenim, and she's the one who comes to the Sanhedrin, and she's the one who is asking for this mitzvah of Yibum. When he refuses, she is entitled and obligated to publicly shame him for refusing that obligation. So that is the presentation of the mitzvah of Yibum in the Torah as it is, as it's presented. So from that perspective, right, the notion lotia eshet hamet achutz l'ish zar, the wife should not be, the widow should not go to an outside stranger. You get the sense that it's her obligation, it's her moral obligation to her as an act of chesed, or as an act of a moral obligation to her deceased husband, and she wants to continue that line, that seed, and so she's asking for the brother-in-law to fulfill that role in a way that will continue the name of the deceased husband for generations to come. That's the context of Yibum. Interestingly, Yibum doesn't have a lot of places in the Torah where we see this actually happening. There are a few, and we want to talk about those few examples that we do have. One of the most famous, of course, is the story of the refusal of Yibum, which is the story of Yehuda and sons Aaron and Onan, and eventually the story of Tamar. And if you look at that context, I think it is Breshit Lamed Chet, so that should be here. When the story of Yehuda and Tamar, which we began, we looked at in a different context a bit ago. Nonetheless, Yehuda, between the story of Mechiret Yosef, Veikach Yehuda Ish Le'er B'chor Shema Tamar. Tamar is Yehuda's son, daughter-in-law, marries Er. Er, for whatever reason, dies. It's unclear what the context is. We talked about it in the context of Mechiret Yosef. And Vayomer Yehuda Le'onan, Bo El Eshet Achicha V'yabem Ota. That is exactly what Yehuda asks of Onan, to marry the widow, to marry the Tamar, who is the widow from Er, and in so doing, fulfill the obligation of Yibum, which is referred to as levirate marriage, because it's the brother-in-law marriage, v'hakem zera le'achicha, and establish offspring for your brother. Anan understood that the child would be that of his brother and not his, meaning it would be identified as whatever that means. For us, it's very strange, but nonetheless, that's the concept. And therefore, he refused, and he also died. And then Yehuda is left with the situation with Tamar. There's a third brother. He doesn't want to give it to the third brother. And Tamar goes off and eventually seduces Yehuda. Sorry. Right. Eventually goes off to and will seduce Yehuda and marry Yehuda himself in order to establish that mitzvah of Yibum. Just interesting observation, there were two brothers who died, Er and Onan. When Yehuda and Tamar have their first offspring, how many are born? Two. Right? Because there's two in correspondence to the two that died. So the Ramban here makes a very obvious observation, which is Tamar seems to be motivated by the concept of Yibum and the demand. Remember, Yibum is a unique scenario because unlike every other context of marriage in the Torah where it is the husband who pursues the wife, in the context of the mitzvah of Yibum, the moral obligation of Yibum falls on the widow, and she is the one who is demanding the marriage to, whether it be the younger brother or it be to Yehuda, in the case of Tamar. Sorry, there's just some background noise. I'm trying to mute that, so if just pay attention if you don't. All right, so the Ramban makes a fascinating observation. Let me just jump to the Ramban. And the Ramban, picking up on the fact that this is a mitzvah of Yibum, and it's a call Yibum, on the other hand, it's not really technically Yibum because Yehuda is not the brother, he's the father, and so how does that operate? And the Ramban introduces us to a very important concept. He says the following. Inyan sod gadol misodot haTorah b'toldot haAdam. In this story of Yibum, there is a great secret of, right? This is sort of almost a Kabbalistic, mystical story. Right? Those who understand the inner Kabbalistic, mystical side of Torah understand this. Not my issue for now, but the technicalities here are very, very interesting. First thing he says is that the concept of Yibum is not introduced into the world in Matan Torah. The concept of Yibum predates Matan Torah. That there was a known phenomenon, whether it be as a sociological phenomenon or a religious phenomenon, already in the days of the Avot, to the value of the concept of Yibum. And that in the case of the death of a husband
next
without children.
On the Isle of Water Wind, Chestnut Avenue. Transfer available to B9. Please exit through the rear door.
So for some reason, there's some...
Yeah, with the person who is not muted, please mute yourself. There's obviously...
Yeah, I just keep muting. I'm muting all, but for some reason, one line keeps unmuting itself. So I just pay attention to that, if you don't mind. Whoever is close, in other words, Ramban's suggesting that pre-Matan Torah, the concept of Yibum wasn't just about a brother. The concept of Yibum was that if somebody died without child, then there was an obligation, a moral obligation, for the next of kin, whoever they may be, of any relation, to marry the widow and continue the line. And that was considered a moral obligation. Ki kol she'ero akarov elav memishpachto, hu asher hu yoresh nachala, yagia mimena toelet. There's a direct correlation between the mitzvah of Yibam and the mitzvah of Nachla. Whoever is closest to the inheritance line would be the one to marry the widow, because it's not just the birth of a child, it's also the continuation of the inheritance line that was part of that legacy. And so, in the case of a context where the brother was not available to do Yibum, so in the case of Yudan Tamar, she demanded it of her father-in-law, which would have been normal or acceptable in the context of Yibum pre-Matan Torah. It's a fascinating observation of the Ramban, because it understands, it unravels the concept of Yibum, not just from a moral legalistic framework, but into a broader philosophical moral obligation within the society of what happens if there is a union. There's an obligation to bring children forth from that union. If that doesn't happen because the husband dies, then somebody needs to step into that role to finish that obligation, and it is the widow who makes that demand.
You know, yeah. It's true, because Yehuda says that she was right.
Right, yeah, for sure.
So it already says that in the Torah, you know.
Yeah, for sure. V'hine. Now, here's the key piece. Nechshav la'achzariyut gdola ba'ach asher lo yachpotz liyabem. If a brother refuses to do so, it's considered to be very cruel. And we give a name to his household, v'karimoto bet chalutzanal ketachalatzmem. Now, I'm skipping a whole piece of this Ramban.
Rabbi, what happens, can I ask a question?
Hang on 1 second. What happens post-Matan Torah? Post-Matan Torah, Chachmei Yisrael HaKadmonim, Mida'atam Ha'inyan HaNichbad Hazeh, our sages, in their great wisdom, understanding of this great thing, Hinhigu Lifnim B'Yisrael, they established a custom in Israel, La'asot HaMa'aseh Hazeh, they established this practice amongst all of those who were considered to be in line for the inheritance. As long as there isn't a prohibition against marriage. And they called this obligation Geula. So let me explain to what's going on here. Essentially, the concept of Yibum, the mitzvah of Yibum, goes through three stages. There's a pre-Matan Torah stage, where Yibum is a moral obligation on any member of the family, household, society, the closer the better. And it has to do with the nachla, the physical inheritance, the spiritual inheritance. If there's a union that has not produced continuation and that husband dies, the brother picks up, or the father-in-law, or the closer the relative, the better, because the idea is to continue the seed of that family from that Yerusha. What did the Torah do? The Torah did not introduce the concept of Yibum. What the Torah did was it limited the allowance of Yibum only to a brother. In other words, what was originally a broader familial obligation of the entire family, the Torah came along and said, no, we're going to limit it. We still want to keep this mitzvah, this practice, but we're going to limit it only to the brother of the deceased husband. However, says the Ramban, there were other relations that are broader, that are not prohibited. For example, instead of a father-in-law is prohibited to a daughter-in-law, but let's say you had a second cousin. And if there was no brother, or the brother didn't want to fulfill the mitzvah, or it was not available to fulfill the mitzvah, so there was a moral obligation on a non-prohibited relative, but somebody who was close enough in line. And though, so in order to distinguish between the legal obligation, we call that mitzvah yibum, and the moral obligation, which was not legal, and we call that mitzvah geula. Why is it relevant? Because that's the key to the story of Megillat Ruth. When Boaz is asked to marry Ruth, and Boaz says, I am from one of the Goalim, but there's somebody closer to me, Ploni Amoni, in chapter 3 and 4. What the conversation there is about is exactly what the Ramban here is referring to. Who is closest in line to fulfill the obligation, though not the legal obligation, but the moral obligation for the deceased husband, Machlon Chilion, by marrying Ruth and redeeming the land, right? And there's a connection between them because it's all about Nachla, right? Who is closest in that line? So initially they thought it was Boaz. Boaz says, no, there's somebody else. But the whole mitzvah is defined. If you look at the Megillah itself, you'll see that the mitzvah is the mitzvah of Geula. If you look at the end of the Megillah in Perek Dalet, you'll see that the whole reference is about the mitzvah, is called Geula. Hineh ha-goel. Boaz Allah Shavi Yesh Hashem, Hineh ha-goel over. The land that Elimelech sold, right? You have an opportunity to redeem the land. And he initially says yes. And then he says to him, if you acquire the land, you also have to marry Ruth in order to establish the name of the deceased on his inheritance. That's the mitzvah of Geula. I can't do it. Because it won't be my child. It'll be somebody else's child. It'll be considered to be on the redemption on behalf of the deceased. You take it. All of this reference to Geula, says the Ramban, is exactly the language of Yibum post-Matan Torah if it's not the brother. If it's a broader relation, it's called Geula. Now, it's interesting to note that there are essentially three examples of Yibum in the Torah, in Tanakh as a whole, that we know of. Two that are explicit, one that's less so, right? The one that's clear is the mitzvah of Yud and Tamar, which we just read, right? The one that Ramban is referring to is the mitzvah of Geula, is the story of Ruth and Boaz. I wonder what you would say if I suggested to you that there is a third example of Yibum pre-Matan Torah in Tanakh, and that is the story of, at least according to the way I'm going to suggest we read the story of Lot and his daughters. Why? Because, go back to the story of Lot and his daughters for a second. And it's interesting that when Sodom and Gomorrah is being destroyed, Lot asks the Malachim for an escape, and he says, okay, I'll hold off on the destruction of the city of Tzoar for you to go and escape there. And so they come to Tzoar, and they're hiding there. Then Lot leaves Tzoar and he goes up to the mountain. Right? Up to the mountain is the mountains of Moab. If you remember the mountains of Moab, somebody else very famous. Lot goes up from Tzoar and he sits in the mountain. There was somebody else who was very famous who sat in the mountains of Hare Moav. You remember? Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu, before he dies, he goes up to the Hare Moav. From Hare Moav, you can see the entire land of Israel. So it's fascinating. So they go up to the mountain, and they're in this cave. So the older one says to the younger one, Avinu Zaken, our father is old, Ve'ish ein ba'aretz levo aleinu kederech kol ha'aretz. And there's no one here who can come to us the way of the earth. So all the Mefarshim understand that to mean that they thought the world was coming to an end. They saw themselves as Adam and Chava all over again. The problem is, and therefore, the problem with that suggestion is they're sitting in Hare Moav, and the only cities that are being destroyed are Stomba, Amorad, Ma'atzuyim, and Tzor. They can't see that the sun is shining on the other side of the Yarden. They can't see that the sun is shining on Ammon and Moab and anywhere else. That the only place where there is a destruction is Stomba, Amorad. It's a hard argument to make. It's possible. It's possible. I grant that it's possible. I would argue, however, that there's another issue here. You'll forgive me for getting a little bit graphic, but the terminology used in the Torah for the act of the union between man and woman in all of Tanakh is lavo el, for a man to come to a woman. There's only two places in Tanakh where the expression is used, lavo al, to come on. One is here, with an ayin, and the other is yavama yavo aleha, is the mitzvah of Yibam. It's the only two places where it's used with an ayin, where the husband will come onto, where the man will come on to her rather than to her, eleha. You can check it. Right? So between those two observations, Rav Meidan has the theory, and I think it's very compelling, that what was happening in this context was not that they thought that all of the lands of the entire world were being destroyed, but rather that the land of Ammon and Moab, the land of Sodom and Amorah was being destroyed, and that there was nobody appropriate to continue the legacy, to fulfill the obligation, the moral obligation of Sodom and Amorah, to continue the legacy, who's going to continue the Nachala, the inheritance, the portion, the land, the society of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so this act, which is also an act of Yibum, in a much broader sense, right, an act of Gula, has that same moral context of the woman who says, okay, we'll do it from our father instead of father-in-law or brother, because, again, the closer the relative, the better. This is a pre-Matan Torah arena. So I want to come back to the story of Ruth. Naomi says to her daughters-in-law, who have come back with her for what purpose? Ostensibly for the purpose of an obligation that they owe the deceased husbands. Yas Hashem imachem chesed kasher asitem im hametim ve'imadi. You have come on this journey for the fulfillment of an obligation you owe to the deceased. Turns Naomi to them and says, God should allow you a new life and a new home. Go back to your mother's house. Go back to your husband's house. Find new husbands. I absolve you of that obligation. And that's really the tension here. It's not about conversion yet. It's about the concept of Yibum as it applied societally across the board. Right? And so certainly in the arena of Moab, descended from Lot and his daughters, assuming that our theory is correct, that would have been a prevalent understanding or context. And she says to them, Yas Hashem Mechem, Lech Nashovna Isha Lebet Ima, go back to your mother's home. Yas Hashem Mechem Chesed, God should repay the kindness you have shown to me and the deceased. And I absolve you of that. Yiten Hashem lechem umitzena minucha isha beit isha. Go find yourselves new husbands. Meaning, I absolve you of that obligation to the deceased husband. You may now go on with your lives. And that's precisely what happens. Naomi, well, first they say no. First they push. And they say, no, we want to go with you. And then in Pasuk Aleph, she says to them, why are you going to come with me? Am I going to be able to have husbands for you? Am I going to be able to have children now that you can then wait for and marry? Shovnav Natai? You're going to wait for them? Are you going to wait for them to go up that you can marry them? Right? That's an obligation. That would be the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Yibum. Right? But there's no other sons to marry. So what am I going to have new, more children? And so that child you will be able to wait for? Are you going to wait for him to grow up to be able to have fulfill the mitzvah of Yibum? It's not going to work. Go home. And with that, she absolves them completely of that obligation. Interesting. There's a fascinating discussion here in the context of the mitzvah of Yibum, whether or not halachically there's a mitzvah of Yibum with a brother who was born after the death of the husband. Because she says here, even if I were to have a child tonight, would you wait for him to grow up? So that doesn't work halachically, because the halacha is that Yibum only is an obligation on a living brother, ki yeshvu achim yachadav. But what it does reflect here is her understanding that there is no, and forget Yibum for a second, there is no option for these two women to come back with her to the fields of Moab, from the fields of Moab to the city of Beit Lechem, and find husbands, find lives for themselves, find a future for themselves. Who's going to marry a Rut or an Orpah who have come back with her from the fields of Moab? Again, given everything we know about the land of Israel, the Jewish people at that time, who's going to accept them? Who's going to marry them? Not only are they foreigners, not only are they outsiders, but on top of everything else, the Moabites. It's not reasonable. Go home. And so finally, Orpah listens to reason and
I'm listening to a shir.
Vatishak Orpah Lachamota. Orpah acts, responds, I would say, rationally. And Ruth, Dafkaba Ruth, clings to Naomi and, in somewhat of an irrational way, says, no, I'm coming with you. Naomi, for the third time now, says to Ruth, your sister-in-law has returned to her people and to her God. So there's a fascinating discussion in the Mefarshim and the Medrash. What was the status of Ruth and Orpah prior to the moment of their return to their people? Meaning, just to put into context, the Rabag makes the claim, sorry, Ibn Ezra makes the claim that when it says that she returned El Amavi El Aloha, it means that obviously they had to have converted to Judaism at some point prior to that, because her return to her people was a return to her God. Right? So says the Ibn Ezra. On the other hand, the Medrash says, and it's actually machloket in the Medrash, but according to one version, Ve'isulem Nashim Moaviot Tani B'Shem Rabbi Meir Lo Gerum V'Loit Bilum. They didn't convert, and they didn't tovel, and they didn't do any of that. Right? It's not context. There's no context for the sort of a technical concept of conversion when you're living in Moav. And so, if that's true, what does it mean when it says that she returned to her people and to her God? The context in Tanakh is that there is an association, certainly in the world of, in the global understanding of theology of that time, God's peoples and lands were all connected. Let me say that again. In the worldview of the moment, outside of Israel, we're going to talk about that in a second, there's a direct correlation between land, people, and God. So a land has a people, and that land and that people has the God of that land and of that people. And so when she returns to her people, she returns to the gods of her people as well. Just that's the expression, that's the association. And the truth is that in the minds of most people at that time, that was true for Israel as well. It just happens to be an interesting observation that Israel is the only people in the world at that time whose relationship with God starts outside of its land. That's not an accident. Right? The whole reason for Shibut Mitzrayim, taking us out of Egypt, the miracles in Egypt, and then receiving the Torah outside of Israel and bringing it to the land of Israel, was to break that dependence of our relationship with God to our existence in the land of Israel. That's a whole sheer into itself. But certainly in the context of Naomi, of Orpah, when she returns to her people, she returns to her gods. And Ruth, on the other hand, Ruth insists that, no, I am coming with you. Not only does she insist on coming with Naomi, but when she expresses this in a very famous speech that carries through Psukim Tetzayin and Yetzayin, she re-emphasizes exactly what Naomi has just been saying to her. Vatomer Rut, Al tivgi'i bi lo'ozvech, do not press me to abandon you, lashuv mi'acharayach, ki al asher telchi elech, where you go, I will go, b'asher talini alin, where you lie, I will lie, ve'amech ami, ve'lokayach lokay, your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Ba'asher tamuti amut, where you die, I die, v'sham ekaver, and there I will be buried. What's going on in all of this psukim? Leave out for a moment the phrase, Amech ami ve'lokai cholokai, just the phrase, where you go, I will go, where you sleep, where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. To what is Naomi, what is Ruth referring to, if not the fact that Naomi has said to her, I am going back to the land of Israel, to nothing. I have no land. I have no home. I've sold my land. So I don't even have what the basic core of Nachalah is as an inheritance, which is a burial plot. What is a burial plot in Tanakh? A burial plot in Tanakh is Kever Aviv, is a Nachalah, is an inheritance. And you didn't have public cemeteries. You were buried in your ancestral land. Naomi says to her, I don't have even a place to be buried. To which Ruth insists and says, where you go, I go. Where you lie, I will lie. If you're going to sleep in the street, I'll sleep in the street. If you're going to die without a burial place there, I will be I will as well. Not even death will force us apart from each other. And her loyalty to Naomi is absolute 1,000%. But it's fascinating that it's a loyalty that says, despite the fact that I will have no husband, because nobody will marry her, that Naomi made crystal clear, there's no mitzvah of Yibum, She's absolved of the mitzvah of Yibum. And so Ruth, from that point of view, at that moment, is saying, I will go with you, even if it means I will remain unmarried the rest of my life. I will live with you, I will take care of you, and I will die with you. That's the message Ruth conveys to Naomi. There is no hope for Ruth to find a husband. There is no land for her to live off of. She's going to have to provide the sustenance for Naomi. She's going to have to provide, she's going to have to live a single life for the rest of her life. From that perspective, there is no anticipation of Boaz on the horizon. And Ruth says, so be it. Amech ami v'lokayach elokai. Which is why Ruth has always stood as a sort of the classic paradigm of sort of conversion of somebody who comes in from the outside, converts, who says, I want to be part of the Jewish people, right? The classic paradigm is Ruth. And in fact, the Gemara learns all the laws of conversion that we have today from the story of Ruth. Right? When the Gemara in Yavama says that well, somebody comes and wants to convert, then we try to dissuade them, and we dissuade them three times, but we don't dissuade them more than three times, because Naomi tried to dissuade her daughters-in-law up to three times and not beyond. We learn that we give them a sampling of the various mitzvot of the Torah, some mitzvot kalot, mitzvot chamurot, some of the more stringent commandments, some of the less stringent commandments. We do this, we learn this from Ruth, and the Gemara quotes the entire conversation from Ruth to demonstrate what we learn in terms of the way in which we push away, but at the same time accept potential converts. All of this is learned from the story of Ruth. I'm not going to go through the details of that right now, because it's not really relevant to us. But I just wanted to make this observation that Ruth is a fascinating classic example, but a unique example, meaning she becomes the paradigm for a very specific reason. Let me put it to you in this way. Who's the first person to convert, and in quotation marks, into the Jewish people? Meaning to come into the Jewish people from the outside, which is technically what conversion is. Who's the first person?
Abraham Avinu.
Oh, so somebody's going to say Abraham, and the answer is no. Abraham wasn't converted. Abraham was chosen. Different. Right? Abraham and Sarah were chosen. So Yitro? Abraham would define the Jewish people. So who's the first person to come into the Jewish people from the outside?
Yitro.
Yitro.
No, Yitro was the first. No. Who was the first in the context of the Jewish people and the peoplehood of the people, right? Nationality. Right? Who's the first person to be an outsider and come into the people? Rivka. It's not Avraham and Sarah, because Avraham is chosen. Yitzchak is born. But the first person to choose to enter the Jewish
people. Eliezer.
Even before Eliezer doesn't convert and then never actually becomes part of that, remains a domestic Beti Eliezer. The first person to enter into that family dynamic is Rivka. And in the story of Parshat Chayei Sarah, after the death of Sarah, when Eliezer, or Eved Avram, as it says, goes to find a wife for, which I'm going to stop sharing because I don't need to share for this part. This is just, right? When Eliezer, or Eved Avram, goes to find a wife for Yitzchak, there are two tests of that loyalty that Eliezer has to demonstrate or devises to demonstrate the willingness of that individual. And they are, what are the two tests that Rivka has to go through?
Chesed and leaving her family and coming back to Yitzhak.
Right. She has to be willing to leave her family to enter, to come back to the land of Israel. And she has to demonstrate the character trait of Chesed, which is exactly what Yitzchak devises. Those two tests I have nothing to do with Yitzchak. But what they are is a repeat of the very same beginning of the journey of Abraham himself. Abraham's first command is Lech Lecha, to leave his father's house to come to the land of Israel. And B was the character trait of Chesed, right? There's a certain contradiction in being both a foreigner and a balabait. To be the Baal Chesed, you have to be the balabait. To be the Lech Lecha, to be the foreigner. Right? That tension is exactly what Abraham was posed with. Those are precisely the two tests that Rivka has to undergo in order to be willing to make that journey Lech Lecha and to be the Chesed of the continuity of the house of Avram and Sarah. That's where she comes in from the outside. Well, those are exactly the two tests that Ruth has to undergo. Because her first test is Lech Lecha, the willingness to go and journey. And actually, if you look at the way it's presented in the text, fascinatingly, in chapter 2, when Boaz presents to Ruth what he's heard about her, and he says, "Vayomer Boaz, Vayomer la, Hugedu Gad li kol asher asita tchamotech achrei mot ishech. I've heard about what you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband. Vatazvi avich veimech veeretz moladetech. How you left the house of your father and your mother and the land of your birthplace." It's exactly the language of Parsha Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha mi'artzecha mi'latecha mi'bet avicha, right? V'techi alama shelo yadat, Moshe Usho. That's her first test. And of course, the second test, which is the test of Chesed, which she demonstrates left, right, and center. So Ruth is, in a sense, the classic paradigm of conversion, precisely because she undergoes in her willingness to accept, to enter into the Jewish people, she undergoes the same process that Rivka underwent when she entered into the Jewish people as well. She also had to be, in a sense, tested. Her loyalty, her commitment, her devotion had to be demonstrated in this fashion. Why is it so important? So it's fascinating, and I entitled this shiur as the problematic nature of female conversion in Tanakh. What does that mean? So what's fascinating is that when you look at the concept of conversion, as it appears in the Gemara and Yevamos, as it appears in the Shulchan Aruch, it's typically identified from the perspective of a male convert. That's not because it's sexist, that's because it's practical, meaning, Ger shenichnas l'kahal Yisrael, a convert who enters into the congregation of Israel, says the Shulchan Aruch, based on the Gemara above. First step, chayav mila. He has to undergo circumcision. And if he undergoes circumcision, if he's willing to undergo circumcision, that is in itself an objective test of their commitment, right? If somebody wants to undergo circumcision, the last time an individual or a group wanted to enter into the congregation of the household of Abraham and underwent circumcision to do so was the story of Shechem, right? And we all know what that Mesiras Nefesh cost them, right? But the notion, it's an objective criteria that says, hey, if you really want to cross that threshold, this is what it's going to require. That is an objective criteria that makes it very challenging. And somebody wants to do it. That's really a demonstration of a willingness that, and a Mesiras Nefesh, and a commitment and a devotion that is real. A person going to go circumcision, that's not an easy operation, especially in ancient times. Person who comes to convert, Kishabalit Kayer, says the Shulchan Aruch. The first thing we say to them up to three times is we try to dissuade them. Maraita, what did you come to us for? Why do you want to convert? Don't you know that Israel at this time is punished and oppressed and hopeless? There were periods of time when that was more relevant and that was less relevant. Today, I think it's more relevant than it's ever been. Right? But we say to them, what do you need all the tzaras for? And if they say, I know that Israel is so oppressed, but I want to do so anyway, we accept the miyad, right? We teach them the laws of some of the stringent laws, some of the less stringent laws. We teach them the foundations of theology. And im kibel, if he accepts all this, malinoto miyad, they undergo circumcision. Then we wait for them to get better, to heal from the circumcision. They go into a mikvah and they are accepted. But again, if the context is mila, that is an objective criteria that is almost the clearest test of sincerity that you're going to have. Because for them to undergo a medical procedure, a surgical operation, that's a demonstration of willingness and commitment. The problem is, what do you do with women? What do you do with a woman who wants to come to convert? And in most cases, right, a meal is not relevant. So the question becomes, how do you define a criteria that is objective in the case of a woman who says, I want to come and be part of the Jewish people? Understand the context of the problem. The context of the problem is we have many examples of converts in Tanakh. We have the story of Shlomo Melech who marries Bat Paro and all of his wives, political marriages. We have the story of Shimshon. We have the story of the time of Ezra and Nehemiah and all the men who came back and they were married to non-Jewish wives. There are many examples of individuals in Tanakh who marry outsiders or non-Jewish wives and bring them into the context of the Jewish people, ostensibly huge discussion in halacha. But they're all questionable in terms of do they convert or don't they convert. There are absolutely no examples outside of the story of Shechem. There are no examples of male converts in Tanakh. Why not? So the first thing you say to them is your circumcision. And the answer is still next week. Or the week after that, or forever, right? So the context here is, how do you define an objective criteria that reflects or that demonstrates a loyalty and a commitment? In the context of Mila, you have it. In the context of the women, you don't have that objectivity. You don't have that objective scale that says, do this and you've shown your loyalty. Remember, conversion today is very different than it was in the time of Tanakh. In the today, religious life and national life are independent of each other. And so today, it's a very simple criteria, right? Are you willing to accept upon yourself the mitzvot and live a religious lifestyle which is totally independent of societal norms? But in the context of Tanakh, that's not the case. Right, you've got one society, one context of a woman comes in from the outside, or whether it be a Moabite, or whether it be an Egyptian, or whether it be from any society, and enters into the Jewish people and now is living in the land of Israel. So from all intents and purposes, she's going to live in a world in which she can live as a Jew. Right? She's going to live in the context of her husband's arena. Food that's going to be prepared is kosher. Shabbos is part of the national existence, whenever the context is. But in order to enter into the Jewish people from the outside, you need the criteria, you need the objective tests that Rift had, that Rus had. And that's much harder to find, which is why in Tanakh, you have constant tension around these marriages. Paro. Shlomo Melech marries the daughter of Paro. Shlomo Melech marries 1,000 wives. I'm no doubt in my mind that in his perspective, he brought these women into his arena to quote-unquote convert them. But what does that mean? In the end of his life, they took over. And so one example stands apart from all of the other examples of conversion of women who come into the Jewish people from the outside. It's one exception, because it's the only example we have outside of Bechlal, in all of Tanakh, of somebody who enters the Jewish people with the explicit understanding that they're not coming to marry a Jewish husband. They're not coming to enter into a society in which they would just kind of integrate by themselves, but rather have to stand apart from the rest of society. No husband, no family, no parnasa, no land, no ancestral land, no burial place. Ruth, from her perspective, from every vantage point, says that it lives a moment in which she has to take all of those classic societal norms of what it means to live in a land and a society and a people and say, I'm not going to have any of that. And yet I want to be part of your family. Yet I want to be in your household. Yet I want to accept your God. Elmech ami v'lokayach elokai. Her demonstration, her loyalty, stands apart from any other paradigm in Tanakh, which is why, with all of the problematic issues that we have in Tanakh as a whole, with Neshe Shlomo, with Shimshon, with all of the other paradigms we have of people who marry outside of the Jewish people and the complexities they create, one paradigm stands apart, and that's Ruth. And that would explain why Ruth becomes the paradigm that defines the halacha. Right? Every aspect of conversion today is modeled after the story of Ruth for exactly that reason. All right, we've overstepped by 3 minutes, so I will stop here. And there was one more piece of the story, which is the story of Eshet Chayil. We're going to leave that for now. Another time we'll have an opportunity to study the parak of Eshet Chayil. It's a very good... we'll leave that for some point in the future. I will take
you very much, Rabbi. Questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a wonderful shiur.
My pleasure.
I have a question.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Yeah. My question is, at what point of our history, Vayikra chapter 20, verse 21, because it says that a man should not marry his sister, his husband, his brother's wife, you know, in Kiddushin.
Okay.
Right. So that had to be maybe after the Torah was given? Or...
No. So let me clarify. There is a prohibition against a husband marrying his brother's wife.
Yeah.
There is also an obligation in the Torah for a husband, for a man to marry his brother's wife in the case of Yibum. The mitzvah of Yibum is the one exception. Remember, we talked at the beginning about the fact that pre the giving of the Torah, the concept of Yibum was the closer the relation, the better. Brother, father, father-in-law, right? Yehuda and Tamar, Lot and his daughters. What the Torah did is it took all those relations and said no, except one. It left the brother, even though typically a brother is not allowed to marry his husband's wife, in the case of the mitzvah of Yibum, that becomes the exception. And he's obligated to do so unless he does chalitza.
So what I'm hearing is that this is an exception that they provided for.
The Torah created one exception to that rule and mandated it in the case of Yibum. Correct. Okay.
And the other thing, maybe, why men do not convert as freely in that society, because when you think about it, the land was by tribe. What happens when the convert of a man comes into that?
There's no land.
Right.
True, but that is a... You can always buy land. There were ways in which to buy land and acquire land, even if it's not by tribe. I think circumcision was a much bigger deterrent. But it's possible. Both are relevant.
Thank you, Rabbi.
And both were not relevant to Naomi, right? To Ruth. That's exactly my point. Is that whatever criteria are typically there for a husband, for a man, right? Ruth didn't have those objective criteria, and so her conversion becomes a very different context.
Thank you.
If the,
If the Torah limited just to a brother, then how come the Goel at the end of Ruth was like a further relative, and then Boaz was even further than that? He said, you know, a Goel Karov,
right.
And then...
So go back to that Ramban with which I started. That was exactly the point. That's the Ramban says that that's how what happened post the Torah is that the Torah limited the legal mandate of Yibum
only
to
legal.
The brother. But Chazal left a broader moral obligation right. of Yibum to a non-prohibited relation. Then the closer the better. It had to do with the Nachla.
Right.
Where the
right.
line of the Nachla would be.
Yeah, but she didn't have a Nachla because they
no.
lost it.
Elimelech
she couldn't. Did. No, but
Elimelech's
a woman at that time.
You're missing the point. Stop. Right. It's Elimelech's Nachla. The Nachla of the deceased.
You know, but she didn't.
It's the Nachla of the deceased husband. It's Elimelech's Nachla, that's the question.
Right.
So Elimelech's Nachla has relations that are closer, and the closer the relation, the more obligation there is to marry Ruth.
So the Nachla was kept there, even though he betrayed them, and even though he went away, and whatever the Nachla was
there,
waiting for it.
It's ancestral land. Whoever had to redeem it, had to buy it back. Please, God, one day we'll get the Perek Dalet.
The other question is, isn't it like when Ruth is saying, I'll follow you, it's not exactly her main thing was to follow Ruth and her loyalty to a person. So it's a very much a personal thing, you know, like wherever you'll go,
no
I'll go, you know, whatever. So it's
no question her motivation.
So where do they get from that, like the structure for...
So two things. First of all, she says,
but the reason is personal.
Okay. And with Rivka, it wasn't?
No, because she didn't even know. I don't know. She hated her father, maybe. I don't know what Rivka, you know. But,
Rivka yeah, came to marry Yitzchak.
No, I know, but she didn't know him. It's not like that there was a great love there. I mean, she went there on blind date, you know. It's like...
Okay. It's even more so.
You know, it's like...
Even more so. Even more so.
Okay.
All right, Masai. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Yes.
Thank you for your share.
The two sons of Jacob that died are the grandsons, the two boys that died.
Yehuda,
the grandsons. This is tertiary, but do you think the punishment fit the crime that they didn't want to do the Yibum thing? They died. Is it really a fitting punishment? Does anyone question it that this happened?
Nobody questions it.
It strikes me as, you know, pardon the language, overkill for what went on there.
Only one died because he went to Yibum. The first one died because he...
It says he was Rabbi De Hashem. We don't know what that means. But, that's a capital of whatever. What the context, that's beyond the scope of a discussion right now. It's a much longer conversation. But it's not for us. That's a trickier piece. But I will take it for now at face value. No, I'll take it to face value. I would have to explore that by itself.
I understand, but it always bothers me that this doesn't seem like a capital offense. That's all.
Because for us, it's not part of our lives at all.
Even back then, I think it's way too harsh a punishment. Just because it happened doesn't mean I think.
Okay. I hear what you're saying. I reserve judgment for another time. All right, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
No,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.